Good morning. It's Sunday, July 12th. Time for the morning roundup of world news as reported in the war capitals of the Allied nations. First, from the newsroom in San Francisco, we take you to one of our reporters in the Southwest Pacific.
This is Martin Agronsky with General MacArthur's headquarters. The week on this front ends tonight with the overall picture of both our own and the enemy position practically unchanged. Yesterday and Friday, the Japs renewed their high-altitude bombing of our Port Moresby base in New Guinea, causing what our communiques describe as slight damage. Our bombing of the Jap bases in New Guinea and the Solomons to the northeast and in Timor to the northwest was, as usual, more consistent than the sporadic Jap bombing activity, but at no time as heavy as our fairly large-scale raids of July the 4th. Considering the small numbers of bombers which we've been sending over the Jap bases, it would be foolish to imagine that our Air Force is doing much more serious damage to the Jap than the enemy has been doing to us. Generally, the Jap has for some time been in the extremely fortunate position of being able to consolidate his advanced bases on the Southwest Pacific Front almost at will. At no time have we been able to hit with real force with our bombers at any of the main Jap concentration points like Rabaul in New Britain or Truk in the Carolines. Behind his screen of outlying air bases in New Guinea, in New Britain and Timor, the Jap has been able to plunder at will the riches of Malaya and the Dutch East Indies, to strengthen his entire chain of Southwest Pacific island defenses, and thus daily to grow stronger in raw materials and defensive force against the day when General MacArthur shall be able and ready to take the offensive. The comparative inviolability of the Japs on this front is a bitter pill for our forces, filled as they are with the offensive spirit, to have had to swallow. It's especially bitter when, in addition, every man has the knowledge that each day we delay, the enemy grows stronger, that each day the eventual bill in human life and suffering which MacArthur's offensive must someday present to the American people grows more costly. Sometimes we wonder here, how many of you at home remember the simple little declaration with which General MacArthur took up his duties last March 21st as Commander-in-Chief in the Southwest Pacific? The words he used are no less true today than they were then. I'd like to remind you of them. They were, I quote, "Success in modern war requires something more than courage and a willingness to die. It requires careful preparation. This means the furnishing of sufficient troops and sufficient material to meet the known strength of a potential enemy. No general can make something out of nothing. My success or failure will depend primarily upon the resources which the respective governments place at my disposal." Unquote. This is Martin Agronsky returning you now to San Francisco.
Now for reports on developments here at home, we take you across the nation to the newsroom in Washington.
The House Ways and Means Committee hopes to get the new tax bill before the House this week. In fact, Thursday has been mentioned as the day on which consideration of the giant fundraising measure will begin. A coalition of Republicans and administration Democrats took command of the bill yesterday, and before they had finished their work, the tentative corporation tax schedules had been completely overhauled, and the so-called at-the-source income levies were all but discarded. The changes increased the net revenue of the bill by some $900 million, and although the total yield of the measure is estimated at $6.25 billion, it is still more than $2 billion short of the Treasury Department's goal. Many members have advocated raising this amount by the sales tax method, but Capitol Hill observers now believe that this type of taxation is definitely dead. Representative Robertson of Virginia, one of the strongest supporters of the sales tax, has just completed an informal poll of the House, and the results of this inquiry are said to show less than 50% of the membership in favor of the sales levy. In the meantime, Price Administrator Leon Henderson is anything but satisfied with the appropriations bill which Congress is preparing for his agency. But the indications are that he will have to take it, whether he likes it or not. Congress is already in an angry mood, and there are reports that two drives will be launched in the Senate to recapture some of the wartime powers which have been delegated to such agencies as OPA, WPB, and the Office of Petroleum Conservation. The Senate Appropriations Committee, which is particularly peeved over Henderson's recent order, raising gasoline prices on the eastern seaboard by 2.5 cents a gallon, wants to annul the increase. And the Senate's Commerce Committee wants to annul the WPB-OPC ruling that only one oil well may be drilled on each 40-acre tract of ground. Veteran reporters in the Capitol feel that these two battles are likely to produce more fireworks than the Senate has seen in a long time. Meanwhile, although at the present time the United States has plenty of sugar, rationing will continue because we can't depend on the future. Price Administration officials say that a small stockpile of sugar is accumulating, that we have 5% more than we are using, but they warn that our supplies are dependent on shipping, and the shipping situation is not good. In fact, a total of at least 34 vessels were sent to the ocean bottoms of the world during the past week alone. And with these newly announced losses, the total of vessels sunk since the war began soars to 3,185, while the toll of known dead mounts to nearly 42,000 officers and seamen. And it's pointed out, this does not include the well over 12,000 men who are still listed as missing and unaccounted for. Britain is by far the heaviest loser, with well over 1,100 vessels, a figure nearly four times as large as that of Norway, which ranks second in the number of losses. Our own total so far is 225 ships left on the bottom of Davy Jones' locker. And while the nation needs ships, it also needs every hand which it can find to help keep the wheels of our great production machine turning. And President Roosevelt says that no one should be denied the right to work simply because he is an alien. This is not only unfair, Mr. Roosevelt says, but is definitely dangerous to the country's war effort. Mr. Roosevelt's statement is based on a survey of alien unemployment, a survey which he has forwarded to Chairman McNutt of the Manpower Commission. And so for the moment, that's all the news from Washington.
Our next report comes from the Middle East. We take you to Cairo, where Grant Parr is waiting with news of the battle for Egypt. Go ahead, Cairo.
Hello, New York. This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. Australian troops, which have been prominent in the British attack west of Alamein, were busy yesterday mopping up the strip of desert they've just occupied and consolidating their position. In the process, they increased their bag of Axis prisoners to 2,000. Meanwhile, there was fighting in the central part of the Alamein front with British armored columns and artillery pitted against sections of the enemy tank group. In the south, British mobile columns met little opposition. Although the battle is still going on, fighting has not been particularly fierce since the initial Allied push. During the first day's operation, Australian troops drove through Italian manned defensive positions in the north. Subsequently, German tanks entered the fighting, but failed to push back the Australians. Meanwhile, German mixed forces advanced in the south as a part of a scheme to consolidate positions there against further pushes by the New Zealanders. Yesterday, the Germans gave this up, and it's quite likely that Nazi elements are being rushed back north to reinforce the Italians. Further enemy counter moves might result either in the center or the north. Of the 25 odd Junkers tramp bullfighters attacked recently over the Mediterranean, it's now known that three were definitely shot down and that nine or more others were damaged. The most significant thing is that these giant aircraft were loaded with troops, at least 25 men to each plane. The German soldiers stuck their Tommy guns through the windows of the plane and fired at the bullfighters, but none of the British machines was damaged. Although German troops carried by air usually have life-saving equipment, no survivors were seen on the water after the three planes sank.
Axis air activity was on a very large scale yesterday, and British fighters attacked well-escorted enemy formations, which were 40 to 50 bombers strong. One night, very recently, a British bomber crashed in the Mediterranean, just off the Egyptian coast. Three British sailors, hearing cries for help, took a launch and went out to investigate. They found the rear gunner with his feet caught in the wrecked gun turret. He could just keep his head above water. One sailor lit a cigarette, swam to the trapped man, and gave it to him. Then they set about the rescue. That meant cutting an iron bar with a hacksaw, and underwater. It took 3 hours. The men were hampered by oil in the surface of the sea, by hundreds of blue jellyfish which covered their bodies with stings. But they saved the airmen. This is Grant Parr in Cairo, returning you to New York.
And now to the British capital. We turn to London and to John McVane.
This is London. During the daylight of early evening yesterday, giant British Lancaster bombers made the longest daylight raid of the war to bomb the two Baltic ports of Flensburg and Danzig. The round trip between Britain and Danzig is something like 1,600 miles. The Lancasters have been called the most efficient heavy bombers in the world. They're the fastest and carry the biggest bomb loads. Several squadrons took part in the attack. They came down over Danzig well below the clouds and let their bomb loads go on the port's important submarine yards. Flensburg is the capital of Schleswig, near the border between Germany and Denmark. British bombers made low-level attacks on the submarine yards there, and air crews saw their bombs burst on the slipways. Usually, daylight raiding over occupied territory is the most costly form of raid, but yesterday the British lost only 3 planes. The planes may have flown more than the 1,600 miles to detour around anti-aircraft and fighter defenses. The last time Danzig was raided was on November the 10th, 1940. Lancasters have been used in the 1,000 bomber raids, but the last time they came into prominence was in the daylight raid on Augsburg. About 3 hours ago, RAF fighters flew low over the British coast, heading for France. Most of today's London papers print extracts from the U.S. Army's pamphlet of advice to American soldiers in Britain. The booklet tells the soldiers something about the people and the customs of Britain. The advice is sound and was evidently compiled by someone who had a thorough knowledge of the British. The booklet should go a long way toward bridging the gap between Americans who aren't used to living with the British and Britishers who haven't had much contact with Americans. You see a lot of American soldiers in London these days. Traveling around among British units, you meet many more scattered here and there as observers, helping link British and American methods of warfare. American officers and soldiers are well liked here. They haven't made the mistake of bragging about themselves, and most seem to remember that, in the words of the U.S. Army booklet, there are housewives in aprons and youngsters in knee pants in Britain who've lived through more high explosives and air raids than many soldiers saw in first-class barrages in the last war. British Army men are invariably interested in the fine American equipment. How highly they'll regard the Americans as fighters will depend on how the first American units here behave under fire. The Bataan defenders won British admiration and set a high example for Americans in this theater of war to follow. There's one point about American Army dress that seems a little out of place in a war area. Decorations on British Army uniforms usually mean the wearer has been under fire. Britisher sees a young American soldier or officer with a couple of medals and perhaps a couple of ribbons on his chest. His first thought is the American must have done a lot of fighting. Then he finds the decorations mean the American has been in the Army for several months, perhaps taken a course at a flying school, and is considered pretty handy with a machine gun and a rifle. But the American hasn't yet killed any Germans or been bombed or shot at. The Britisher may be a soldier who went through Dunkirk or Narvik, or an airman who's flown a dozen times over Berlin, and he still doesn't wear any medals or ribbons. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
These have been the reports of Martin Agronsky from Australia, Grant Parr from Cairo, and John McVane from London. From the newsroom in Washington came a report of developments here at home. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.